And then there's also really attuning to your kid and sort of noticing, like, is it safe for my kid to keep doing this? I want parents to sort of be asking that question, because then down the line, especially as things get more and more rigorous and competitive, there are going to be some kids that it is in their best interest safety wise to counsel them away from those activities. Like, we can't as a family allow a child to engage in like dieting behaviors or, let's say, disordered eating behaviors in pursuit of their specialized sport.
Today, we're talking about fostering a positive body image and a healthy mind-body attitude, especially with kids who are participating in sports that have a high focus on the body. Activities like dance, gymnastics, wrestling, and many more that we'll get into in this episode. Joining me for this conversation is Zoe Bisbing. She is a psychotherapist who specializes in body image and eating disorders. She's the creator of Body Positive Home, and she's a mom of three. In our conversation, Zoe emphasizes the importance of creating secure attachments from the start, laying a foundation of resilience that can withstand diet culture and societal pressures. She unpacks this important distinction between body image and body positivity, shedding really interesting light on the nuanced interplay between these actually different concepts that show up in our culture. And importantly, she discusses the delicate balance between supporting an athletic passion and the potential risks to the physical and mental well-being of young athletes, and always highlighting the importance of helping our children and ourselves make informed decisions when it comes to participating in these sports. Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Bren, a clinical psychologist and mom of two. In this podcast, I've taken all of my clinical experience, current research on brain science and child psychology, and the insights I've gained on my own parenting journey, and distilled everything down into easy to understand and actionable parenting insights, so you can tune out the noise and tune into your own authentic parenting voice with confidence and calm. This is Securely Attached. Hi, welcome to the show. We have Zoe Bisbing on. Thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited about this conversation that we are planning to have today.
Thank you for having me.
So you and I kind of know each other from the world of psychology and therapy in New York, but this is the first time we're having like a real conversation about this stuff. Can you let people know a little bit about like the work that you do, your particular kind of focus? And then we could jump into talking about all kinds of fun stuff.
Sure. So, that's right. So we know each other as sort of what colleagues in the mental health space in New York City. And I guess by day, I am a therapist. I specialize in eating disorders across the lifespan. I have a sort of subspecialty in children and adolescents and families with respect to disordered eating and eating disorders. But the practice I direct and my own practice, we work with, you know, people into their older years as well, because eating disorders and disordered eating does not discriminate on the basis of age or really anything. I'm also a mom of three. And so my work as an eating disorder professional combined with my sort of evolution as a parent really drives my work, which is sort of like my heart is in prevention and early intervention and really advocacy around helping parents and helping professionals and everybody understand what we actually can do on the front end to improve the air quality, improve the environmental protective factors for our young people, so that hopefully, as I always say, like one day I'll put myself out of business and like won't be able, you know, there will be no more disordered eating and eating disorders to treat, which is a pipe dream. But I think the sentiment is there, right? Like I know how hard it is, you know, to even be a therapist working with families who have a very entrenched 14-year-old dealing with an eating disorder. I know how hard it is to treat a 40-year-old who's been struggling with disordered eating for 20, 30 years. And again, we can't always prevent, but I'm sort of obsessed with thinking about creative ways that we can really bring prevention and sort of body image resilience practices to life. And I find that in doing so, there's this unintended consequence of healing for us that happens along the way. So my whole kind of approach to advocacy really is around kind of family-based body image resilience and repair work. And then, of course, going full circle, I am a therapist by day.
It's so funny because I literally am like, I am you and you are me. Like everything you're saying, I like relate to so much, this idea of like, yes, I am by day a therapist. I've never described it that way, but I might steal that from you because by day I'm a therapist. I work with families who have, and I used to work with adults. Actually, how I ended up doing what this sort of preventative work that I do, which is more about family systems and family dynamics and attachment relationships, but same thing, like sub in eating disorders, right? It's like I used to work with adults with like chronic trauma history and attachment trauma in their like early childhood. And when I had my son, my first of two kids, I like started to really study and like as a parent, like more about the psychology of parenting and the psychology of like of the parent-child relationship. And I had done my dissertation on attachment. I was always interested in attachment, but from the retroactive healing of it with adults. And then when I had my kid and I was like learning all these like ways of being with a baby, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. If I like just could see certain things I was doing that were like, this kind of reminds me of what I do with my adult patients to sort of heal trauma and attachment, is like, if I can teach parents about the benefits of developing that secure attachment relationship from the get-go, it's very prophylactic. It's very beneficial. Does it mean that they will never have to like deal with mental health issues in the future? No. It's, you know, there's too many factors. Yeah. But to your point, like, can we build resilience?
Yeah.
And then can we also, this, your point of resilience and repair, I think echoes very much the work that I do with it, with family relationships. It's if we build resilience around attachment ruptures, misattunements, resolving conflict, getting through hard moments, not avoiding conflict, not just completely throwing in the towel. But then also, can we repair when we do lose it? Because we're going to lose it. And we're going to have misattunements. We're going to have ruptures. But if we can repair, then there's so much strength that comes with that to the system. And I feel like that's very much what you're talking about in the language of eating disorders. And how do you create that resilience around from an early age within the family system?
Right.
How to create resilience around our relationships to eating, our relationships to our body. You said, how do we like clean the air? And I'm like, you're right. So much of it is like absorbed by osmosis. It's not so direct.
Completely. No, I mean, the parallel is uncanny, you know, and I think it must be a very intuitive experience for a therapist who becomes a parent, right? Especially if you've worked primarily with adults or even teens, right? Like to then sort of see this little baby and then of course, like want to do everything you can to protect them, right? It comes from a place of that too. And I think that with it probably similarly, right? We're probably both very obsessed with reverse engineering everything we teach or offer intervention wise in treatment. And I mean, that's sort of where my imagination runs really wild. Like I'm thinking about interventions that I use for body dysmorphia with adults and teens. And I've found very creative ways to reverse engineer it into playful games that we can play with kids. And so that's sort of where my kind of mind runs wild. And I think that, you know, I think that with body image, and again, like you said, there's so many factors, but with, you know, disordered eating, they're like psychosocial sort of, it's a psychosocial conundrum, right? Like there's so many factors that go into it. Like, and even if we really like look at the family system and improve as much as we possibly can, right? And what I say, embrace body positive values and build a body positive home, because I really think that's that's the goal, right? That's the goal mm-hmm. to kind of make sure you know you did everything you could as a parent and in a family to heal what you could heal and build resilience where you could build resilience. And then essentially we're sending our kids off into a very toxic, complicated world around bodies and diet culture, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I do think that it's still worth it, right?
Yeah.
But we also have to be mindful of, you know, it's the Wild West out there, and right. we're more about building critical thinking skills, et cetera, but really also embodying values that will be protective too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like building the foundation, recognizing that like somebody else is going to have a lot of say in building the top floors of that house, and we don't get to control that. But if we have that solid foundation, that solid ground floor level, if other people pitch in to like create these upper floors of our child's, you know, sense of self, even if some of that's not great, not yeah. very well put together because other people brought their own kind of crappy tools to the job.
I love it.
That our kid can still kind of have a solid structure to depend on in like hard moments where they are faced with like maybe a really painful experience around how their body was, you know, reflected back to them by somebody, right?
Yeah. Or, I mean, and quite literally making sure home is a place where no matter what your body looks like, it's a good body. And that in our home, we do believe that all bodies are good bodies. Does that mean that this is not Pollyanna work? Like, this is not about teaching kids a lie that there isn't like oppression out there and that there aren't unfair standards, unrealistic standards, et cetera. Like, we can't, like you're saying, you know, we can't prevent them from enduring pain or interacting with people with crappy tools and mm-hmm. and maybe a lot of work to do on themselves, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, we can't undersell the importance of home being a place that you are accepted, all of you, all parts of you, your fat parts, you know, the parts that trigger me because I grew up in diet culture and my parents could never fully accept my body, but and that makes it hard for me to accept your developing body, especially as you accrue more fat in this diet culture, anti-fat world. But I'm committed to making home a place where I'm looking at my biases and I'm making sure that that kid knows that no matter what they hear, no matter what they feel, they are affirmed here. And that's sort of where, you know, where this notion of a body positive home comes into play.
Yeah. And so you make a distinction too between body image and body positivity.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Yes. I mean, these are, I think both body positivity and body image separately are both like wildly misunderstood terms and kind of concepts. I try to explain it like this. Body positivity is a value system. It lives in your values and it's a belief, and it kind of has nothing to do with feeling good about your body. It's not about that. Body positivity is about believing that all bodies, all humans with a body, deserve to have a positive relationship with that body. They deserve equality. They deserve dignity, respect, equal access to employment. Like, you know, body positivity is a radical idea, and it comes out of the 1960s. It's a social movement, right? And by the way, it's not designed for or by people that look like me. I'm like a straight sized cis white lady. Like, that it's not for me necessarily. It centers truly marginalized bodies, the bodies that society really has cast aside and said, that's ugly, that's unacceptable, that's bad. It centers them, right? And it says mm-hmm. every body, no matter how far away it is from the ideal, quote, ideal in our society, that person deserves a positive relationship with that body. And that doesn't even mean that that person could, you know, is guaranteed to have a positive relationship with their body. It's very hard to, you know, for some people to ever get to a place beyond acceptance or neutrality, right? So mm-hmm. again, I want everyone to understand body positivity as it lives in your values, right?
Okay.
And yeah. then body image lives in your brain. And so body image has to do with the way you think and feel, right? And then sort of act in response to the thoughts and feelings about your own body. And, you know, positive body image is also, I think, poorly understood, right? Positive body image is not necessarily that you love everything about your body all the time. positive body image to me is that you don't think a whole lot about your body. Like, you're mm-hmm. embodied, you live your life, you have the privilege of not having to, you know, worry so much about looking at yourself in the mirror or thinking, even, I got to keep my body this way because I only like it this way. This is shaky body image, you know? Mm-hmm. And certainly negative body image is maybe more obviously like when you have a lot of very negative thoughts and feelings that are persistent about your body. So I think it's actually possible to be body positive, let's say in your values, and mm-hmm. have bad body image because mm-hmm. of, you know, of all the things that contribute to negative body image. I think it's also possible to have positive body image, you know, like you just have a lot of body privilege. You never really thought too much about it, right? And also not be particularly body positive because maybe you don't care so much about the sort of social justice issues here. And so I think separating these things out is really important. And then sort of appreciating how they maybe intersect is important too. But I like to really start there with a foundational understanding that these are two different yet interconnected things.
Yeah. I think that's a really helpful way of distinguishing that because I have not really, you know, they are very blurry in our culture. They get interchanged constantly. Another thing you were describing that made me think about body image, it almost sounds like, yes, body image and body positivity interact with one another, but they're separate. But the way you describe body image almost feels like there's continuums even inside of that. Like it sounds like there's a spectrum within body image that can be like positive valence, negative valence, mm-hmm. right? But even there's like another sort of axis, which is like secure versus really insecure, like stable, embodied, integrated versus fragmented, self-conscious, which might not really be about positive or negative, but can be more about like how integrated is my sense of my body.
I think that's really well said. I mean, I actually really like thinking about it that way. It's like a little more dimensional. And you're right, because there's sort of multiple spectrums there. Yeah, I mean, and if you think about it, this is the intersection with body positivity. Like, we don't live in a particularly body positive world. It's trying to be. You know, culture is mm-hmm. shifting a little bit. It's trying. But generally speaking, I think selling the idea of body positivity, it's kind of a joke to a lot of people, you know, like, what do you mean all bodies are good bodies? What do you mean fat's okay? What are you talking about? Like, and so in a way, it's such a ridiculous feat or expectation to put on somebody to improve their body image in a world that is so kind of corroded, right, with negative ideas about bodies. So none of us are a vacuum, right? Like and so what you're talking about, these sort of, I guess I'm adding maybe a third spectrum. It's like this, like it's very hard to kind of get past that fragmented place if you're living in a culture that is essentially reinforcing all the negative, right? Mm-hmm. And then of course we have the sort of different levels of culture, right? You have the broader one and then the family, which mm-hmm. is what we can actually work on, right?
Right. So thinking more in terms of like the everyday, right? What families are contending with. Yes, there are things that we can do inside of our like nuclear family system to increase our child's integrated sense of self and their comfort with their body and the idea that they have a good body. I love that. Like, you have a good body. Your body is good. But there's like all these spokes outside of the family system, right? They go to school, they go to dance class, they play a sport, they have sleepovers. Like, there are so many things, and it's not like we don't want to avoid those things, but how do we help them, assuming we're doing the work at home, and we could talk a little bit about how to shore that up if we're not sure how to do that work at home. But let's say we're doing the work at home and we are sending our kids out into these environments. Are there things we could do to help support like them to transfer those skills of having that integrated sense of self and good relationship with their body and the bodies of others, like out in worlds where, like, you know, I'm thinking like ballet class.
Yeah.
We're totally all standing in front of a mirror and like, it's very hard to not be in your body, or it's very hard to not get into your head about your body and just be in your body.
Yeah. I mean, totally. So, okay. I want to kind of break it down into a few responses. I think the first one is, I'm a realist. Like, I'm a realist when it comes to what any one individual person can do about anything in this world. I'm not negative. Like, I consider myself an advocate, maybe even an activist, you could call me. Like, so I believe we can do more than we think, and also we can't do as much as we want, you know, like on some level, right?
Yeah.
So I'm a realist, and I actually just want everyone to, like, you're not a super person, you know, like, you're not a superhero, you know, like, we are going to be sending our kids into the unknown, period, all the time, right? Mm-hmm. You mentioned ballet. There are absolutely extra risks in certain areas, including aesthetic sports like ballet or wrestling or ice skating, or especially as our, you know, when a kid is 3, 4, it sort of tends to be less risky, although I've heard crazy things about what gets said, and sort of the sort of air quality again of even the mm-hmm. 4 or 5 year old. But certainly as kids get a little bit more specialized, right? And I was one of those kids. I was a very specialized ballet dancer. I grew up in the 90s. I mean, like, this was far worse, I think, than now. But then again, who knows? I hear crazy stuff now. I think as parents, our job is actually just to try to understand what the risk is and then mm-hmm. make informed decisions and do a lot of cost-benefit analyses. And the reality is, you know, a kid in a slim body who's sort of naturally that way, whose eating is meaning normal, like is regular, they're enjoying all their favorite foods, they eat variety, they eat chips, they eat burgers, they eat salad, maybe like fish, like they're sort of, there's a kind of food neutral vibe to this kid's life. They eat intuitively. They happen to enjoy the privilege of being in like a slim body that sort of fits nicely into the mold of what the dance studio needs or what the ice skating team wants. Mm-hmm. It's not that I don't see risk for this kid. There is risk for that kid. But there's a unique risk for a kid whose body is actually naturally not going to be that way. Because what we really want to do as parents is notice, how do I essentially prevent dieting? How do I prevent my child from engaging in behaviors that will help, quote, help them fit into the mold of what they need to look like here, but is actually compromising their physical health and their psychological well-being as well. So in a way, I don't want parents to think that they need to, you know, be in the studio all the time and listening and making sure, like, there's a certain amount of like release that has to happen, right? Mm-hmm. But I do want parents to understand the unique risk factors that exist in a variety of different spaces, take some precautions to like get a sense of like, how does this dance studio feel and think about disordered eating and eating disorders? Are you doing anything here to support the body image of these kids? Are you not? Just want to know, right? I feel like there's some of that. And then there's also really attuning to your kid and sort of noticing, like, is it safe for my kid to keep doing this? I want parents to sort of be asking that question, because then down the line, especially as things get more and more rigorous and competitive, there are going to be some kids that it is in their best interest safety wise to counsel them away from those activities as a matter of safety. Like, we can't as a family allow a child to engage in like dieting behaviors or let's say disordered eating behaviors in, you know, in pursuit of their specialized sport. And as a family, we need to have like policies around that, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of trying to name some of the things we can do, but also appreciating that a lot of what you're doing is like doing that cost benefit analysis and then taking some risks along the way.
Right. And so, yeah. So dance, wrestling, ice skating, are there gymnastics, I would imagine, are there other sports that fall into this category of like aesthetic sports?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I would say that there's, so like, yes, wrestling, what did we say? Ice skating, gymnastics, dance, swimming mm-hmm. is one of them. The sort of team-based sports tend to be a little more protective, like, but certainly running, you know, there's a lot of unfortunate guidance that serious runners are given around being slim in order to improve speed. So it's sort of the aesthetic sports and also the sports that sort of there's always kind of a theme of like the leaner, the better, any sort of sport that's like that. And again, like I said, the team, there's lots of benefits to sports too. Right. So I'm kind of trying to name that as well. We are missing some, I'd have to look them up. It's hard for me to recall gymnastics, dance, ice skating, wrestling, sometimes horseback riding, like that can be one. And there are a few others that I'm forgetting right now.
It seems too, though, that there's this, I wonder if tennis is one.
I mean, tennis, it very well may be. I will say anecdotally, I have seen my fair share of tennis, young tennis players, both in outpatient and inpatient settings, like because of the, I think they're with sports, we're not really going in this direction, but there's also this like the way in which the identity integration is concerning, like becoming too identified with myself as an athlete. I think that is another risk factor, like because if and when it doesn't work out or you have to move away from it, whether it's because of a physical injury or a psychological injury, you know, there's a lot of grief around that, like for you know, teens or younger kids or older people even who are no longer a dancer. Who am I without this? I mean, that becomes its own sort of, again, risk to consider.
Right. And I mean, it's good, I think, to think about these risks. And I'm also, I think there's this interesting balance that we have to kind of factor in as parents or as therapists, that like kids who are engaging in a sport and they're finding it to be more and more and more a part of their identity, a part of their, you know, they're excelling, it's becoming a bigger part of their life. That in and of itself is not unhealthy, right? And, you know, obviously there's this natural atrophy of like, you know, kids try lots of things. They may get, you know, go this level, this level, this level, then, oh, this thing, other thing over here felt kind of cool too. And they, some kids kind of have a more of a broad sampling of sports, but they never really are going to go to college to play that sport. Like they're never going to go into that sort of a more intensive training elite athlete zone, right? I would imagine the kids who kind of peel away from that trajectory of elite athlete have a bit of a protective factor there too, in terms of like how much is their identity being kind of like consolidated into this one role.
Yes.
And also what are the body and diet and sort of like that kind of those factors, how are they getting kind of centralized? But then like, let's say we've peeled away those layers of the onion, you know, those kids are kind of, they've fallen off, but my kid is still kind of going. They're really, really good. They're winning a lot of like serious, you know, achievements. It's becoming more central to their identity. And I also like my thoughts like, okay, there's a little bit of like, is it the sport? Is it the pro athlete? Is it the athleticism and their excellence in that field that's potentially putting them on a track that involves more risk? Or is it possibly like the achievement, perfectionism, intensity, like that actually might be putting them at more risk for eating disordered stuff than the sport? I just wonder about that.
I mean, I think we're going to get into very murky territory because we'll never know, you know, and I think there's an additional component, which I'll just to raise awareness around eating disorder risk. There's this third, I'll add a third that it, you know, might be. And right, again, we'll never know which of the three, and there's probably many more than the three. Part of what I really want parents to be aware of with kids that are in these serious sports, these kids, even if they're not experiencing disordered thinking or body image distress, like they're just super active, sometimes super active kids are unable to actually keep up dietary, like with nutrition, with their developmental needs. And they can sort of be biologically, like physiologically, at risk of disordered eating. So you might have those other things going too, but then low weight actually is a risk factor for disordered eating in and of itself.
Later in life or during?
Throughout. So if it, you know, you hear a lot about very competitive athletes I've experienced this both professionally and also in moms that write to me on Instagram and tell me about their horror story, right? Where they didn't know that their child was weight suppressed because they had strength, they were excelling in their sport. That maybe even their doctor said, well, she's active, she's not gotten her period yet, or she only gets her period every now and then. This is now into adolescence. I'm not so concerned. She looks great. She's healthy. She's achieving. Like, and all along, things get missed, right? So this kid maybe needed, in order to go through puberty effectively, needed to gain like 30 pounds in order to actually keep going developmentally, both for their physiological well-being, their bone health, all the physiological stuff, and also their mental health, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the risks too. This sort of super activity can suppress kids' weight and also disconnect them from their sort of capacity to eat intuitively. That's the sort of other dimension. So mm-hmm. oftentimes I recommend, as a safety precaution for all of these kids, the ones you're describing, the ones that are kind of continuing, I always want these families to have a trusted dietitian that knows about elite sports and eating disorders, to be able to consult with that family to make sure that that family knows what are my kids' nutritional needs, because you can't necessarily trust these kids, not because of disordered eating or thinking, but genuinely they're cut off sometimes from their capacity to get the right amount of nutrition. So mm-hmm. that's its own sort of, you know, thread right. that, and I think in just, it's like, how do we know what's right. here, right?
And so it's like, because we can't know, all we could do, like we were saying, is like right. obviously, encourage from that get-go of like having a body positive home and working on body image resilience, but then understanding like when you go into this world, like helping them kind of just know they're going into a space. Like I almost feel like helping the child be kind of an educated consumer of the sport that they're yes. playing.
100%.
What, like, it's not like don't do these things, especially if you're a wonderful ballet dancer. Like it's not like we're saying like, don't do ballet. It's toxic. You should never do this. We gotta take away this thing that you love, that gives you confidence, that brings you like joy.
It's joyful but, movement. Yeah.
Yeah. It's wonderful. And I don't want to pathologize or like stigmatize any of these sports. It's like not what you do, it's how you do it. I say that all the time.
Yeah. I agree. But, like, yeah.
How do we set these kids up for more success? How do we empower parents to ask those kinds of questions, get those nutritionists? Like, I love that idea of like, if you have an elite athlete, you're probably investing a lot into their athletic career or their athletic experience. Add a nutritionist. Like,
exactly. I always say these kids are already expensive. Like whether it's the gear or the hotels or the point shoes or the coaches, whatever, it's like one of the, I don't even want to call it a hack. It's like, it's one of the things, it's like due diligence. And let me say something. I have a 4-year-old daughter who loves to dance. And I remember with my own sort of complicated experience in the ballet world, saying with friends years ago, I would never let my kid dance. And then when I got to know my little girl, like I see the way she intuitively moves and she loves to dance. Mm-hmm. So I have her in dance class, you know, and I picked the Ailey School because I kind of like a post-colonial dance school for her, where mm-hmm. there's more diversity. Hopefully there's more body diversity. Hopefully we're not in like white supremacy land, which I feel like also kind of infects a lot of these elite sports. Mm-hmm. But to your point, as they get older, the stakes get higher. So I am absolutely not trying to say, keep your kids out of these joyful ways to move. There's so many benefits to it too, especially when you discover that you have kind of movement competence, body confidence. Like there's body image protection in this stuff too. Yeah. That's what's so complicated about it all. But I do think that, right, knowing like what do I need? Who do I need on my team? I'm not going to hire a dietitian. She's 4. I'm not worried about it. But these kids that are dancing every day, you know, working out all the time, like we do need extra support around that. And I do think that making sure that, especially as kids get more specialized and more competitive about it, making sure they see who are the disruptors in those fields, right? Like I think I think of sort of in dance, there's sort of two disruptors I think about. One is Misty Copeland, who I think is doing a lot for the ballet world about challenging what a ballerina looks like. And she's calling out a lot of systemic oppression in the ballet world. So making sure our kids who are dancers see her as a role model, right? And there's lots of ways to step up and say, I challenge the way things are here. When you can have thought-provoking conversations with your kids, like, what do you think about the fact that everybody's body kind of looks the same here? Making sure you're showing like influencers on social media that are fat ballerinas, right? Making sure you're showing like, you know, this is what a dancer can look like too. So again, you want to sort of increase their, it's almost like you want to offer them cognitive dissonance, right? You want them to sort of hold mm-hmm. that in mind so that they're not kind of perpetuating the problem, right? Because someday they're going to have to retire, even if they become professional. And who do, you know what I mean? Like, could they become a dancer that opens a more size-inclusive dance studio, right? Like, this is the way I'm thinking. And mm-hmm. I do also think we want to be modeling such strong values at home. Not that we're like, you know, that we're undermining and like saying, oh, your dance studio sucks. Like, that's not the point, right? Right. But keeping open, like, how are the things you're hearing there different than you're hearing here? Like, we talk a lot about the importance of like all bodies being good bodies. Does it feel that way at your dance studio? You know, I find, and I'm sure you do too, that when there's a good connection with your kid, they do tend to come to you with like the things they've heard that didn't feel right. And that's partly, I think, what we want to try to do. It's almost like raise their ability to sort of say, I heard something that didn't sound right. You know, or in the same way that if a teacher touches them in a weird way, we want them to come and say, you know, my teacher touched me in a weird way that didn't feel right. It's like, I heard some stuff that sounds like didn't sound right. And I've seen this so many times where there's like a little whistleblower, you know, like they mm-hmm. come and they just say, I heard this, this happened. And then, you know, from there, a parent who can be more of an advocate can sort of intervene as needed. So it's not like there's a prescription and this is how you do it, but it's more about thinking critically and making sure home is a place that might feel and look very differently than the ballet school. But I think that contrast is important for kids to see too.
Yeah. No, I think that's so helpful. And I don't want to completely gloss over the home piece because we jumped right over into the not at home part, assuming people kind of were building that safe foundation. But maybe you could talk a little bit before we close just about maybe a few things parents can be mindful of doing at home to create that safe foundation and that security and that resilience around body image.
Yeah. I mean, there are four kind of principles or like thoughts that I sort of feel like kind of distill the essence of a body positive home. Some of these are beliefs and I guess invitations for parents to self-reflect, because I think so much of this has to do with understanding our own biases and like making sure that we are not kind of just perpetuating food and body shame, because that's what most of us grew up with. So the first thought is all bodies are good bodies, and sort of understanding what that means, right? So that might translate to stopping comments about bodies, like when the news is on and you've noticed the anchor has lost weight, like not saying, oh my gosh, she's lost so much weight, because that sort of perpetuates this idea that like that matters, right? Mm-hmm. So sort of stopping body talk and sort of noticing, am I giving body compliments? Am I kind of behaving in a way that makes it seem like it matters more if you have this body versus this body? So I think this can come to life with the books you bring into your home, whether it's for young children that are really celebrating body diversity. Sometimes I think putting up art in your home or making sure that you have access to body diversity so that you're like living those kind of like your home becomes sort of an aid for you there, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think that kind of working on this, or even just sitting and reflecting, all bodies are good bodies. Do I believe that? If I don't, how do I create the optics that I do? So I do mm-hmm. think that that's one of them. All food is yeah. good food is the second one, which is really about bringing more food neutrality into the home and, you know, thinking twice about talking about my diet. The fourth is really appreciating that health is such a tricky word and making sure that, you're noticing ways in which you might be thinking about health as measured by weight and making sure that you're doing some work around decoupling those things so that you're modeling for your kids that health can look a lot of different ways. And that the fourth one is that fat is nothing to fear. So this really ties into all bodies are good bodies. Like we live in an anti-fat culture, and it's actually really imperative for eating disorder prevention to distill that idea that fat is bad, right? Fat is actually essential for growth. It's important for puberty. And actually, it's weight stigma that is like the bigger problem than actually being fat. And so a lot of people hear that and say, well, I don't believe that. I don't agree with that. And, you know, we could do a separate episode on that if you want. But the idea here is to make sure you are modeling a belief that all bodies are worthy, and that in our family, we might think about it differently than you'll hear out in the culture. But you can know that if you're working to believe those things, and that's sort of what I'm trying to help people with, right? Mm-hmm. You are doing a little bit of both eating disorder prevention and like everyday activism, because I do think it helps the culture too.
Yeah. And like you were saying earlier, when we do these kinds of things for our kids, we tend to also heal in inner parts of ourselves, like the child inside that didn't hear that, right, when we were growing up. Even if we had a body positive home, whether that was a conscious choice by our parents or it was just happened, we weren't, again, like we were out in the world, you know, we took in those comments from the ballet teacher or whatever, or read all the teen magazines that, you know, told us as 12-year-olds how to have a 1200 calorie diet and eat nothing, no 0 grams of fat. Like we have our own stuff to heal. And I'm wondering too, like, obviously if you are able to kind of keep these four pillars in mind, I imagine it can be very healing for ourselves.
Enormously. I mean, I think that's the sort of magic of it, right? That when you start, and if even relating to feeding your kids with this mentality, a lot comes up around what you got, what you didn't, exactly like what you're saying. And I'm very moved when I hear from people that follow my Instagram account who don't have kids. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, I am healing my inner child. I don't even have kids. I don't even want kids, you know, but this speaks to me. And to me, that feels almost like more validating than when someone's saying, this is really helping me, you know, relate to my kid or whatever. That's important, of course. But that, I think, is the essence of the intergenerational healing, right? Yeah. And we need it.
Yeah. And I could not agree with you more. And I could see also, like, we're talking about how we might be projecting our own sort of internal toxic relationship to food onto our kids, which obviously in doing this work, we're counteracting that and potentially even healing it. But just in the athletic world, I think there's this other part, like a parallel process, right? Where we there might be times where we're projecting our own experiences onto our child in the, not just at home in the food space and the body space, but outside in the athlete space. Like whether it's my, like, you know, I had this experience as an athlete, or I didn't, and I want you to have it, and I need you to kind of take over where I felt like I had to leave off, and that pressure. And I'm sure there could be body-related stuff and also a whole lot of other stuff that gets put onto that. And, you know, that might be its own episode too.
I have a lot of compassion for those parents. It is its own episode, but I think the thing that I'll say is I feel for these parents of kids that are in that spot, like where there's a lot of opportunity for like ascending, you know, and getting accolades, and sort of, I feel for these parents because they do need to kind of give their all to support that kid, right? I remember my own mom just being like a consummate dance mom. Like just, she bought mm-hmm. me all the stuff and took me everywhere I needed to go and got me the teachers. And like, and in a way, it's very hard to be doing that and also be creating space for all of it to not work out, or creating space for like essentially saying, like, you know, we've taken this as long, as far as your body will let us. And now we have to listen to your body, right? Like, it's very hard to do that because you're sort of all in and then you have to
pull. Policy, right? Like, I already invested this much, whether it was financially or emotionally. Or energetically, like we are in so deep, like now we got to ride this wave all the way to the end. And I think that could be a really scary prospect for parents to hear what we're saying and say like, oh my gosh, maybe there is too much at stake and I don't want to do this. But that's really scary because will the whole house come tumbling down? Mine, my child's, right? If their whole identity is built upon this and we say, you know what, this isn't healthy anymore. It's gotten to a place where the cost is outweighing the benefit for you on a lot of levels. How do we pull back? Oof, it's really
that, I think that it is because you have to be really prepared to tolerate a lot of grief. And then that line between your grief and their grief. And, you know, I was hearing you say that and I thought, oh my gosh, right. Then a certain kid, how do we know when the kid isn't just doing it to keep the parents' dream going? It's like, it's very hard to untangle all that. And I do think it's, you know, just like being able to step back. And again, like that cost benefit analysis, as we're always doing as parents, but I think it's like a unique brand that we have to do for this type of kid who's kind of got these maybe athletic gifts and drive. And I think often those are the kids we don't worry about because they're thriving and they're excelling and they got it. But these are the kids that I really worry about, like their sense of self without it. And also their risk for body image issues and disordered eating.
Right. And I'd throw in there their risk for that sort of perfectionism and rigidity and difficulty being kind of pivoting through the world, like within that identity as a pro athlete of whatever fill in the blank sport and also outside of it. And so, you know, your view, your lens is the eating disorder lens. My lens is sort of the more general mental health lens, but I think there's a lot of potential there for challenge. And so it's, and again, like, and a gift and not necessarily bad, but it's like, as the parent, how do we separate our own kind of stuff out from being projected onto our child and really be able to zoom out and look at the whole child, their whole landscape, not just the role as the athlete. And that's hard, but I think that's really the goal.
I think so. And making it, you know, making it okay, right, to, you know, I think these kids need us to make sure they know that we celebrate rest also. And that, you know, also those kids tend to have, they tend to inhabit bodies that are very celebrated by the culture. And I think we also need to make it really okay for their bodies to change as they step back. I think that that's a really hard, like puberty is a really hard transition for a lot of parents to watch their little babies who were like skinny and scrawny, like start to like chunk up and plump up. And some of those kids are just going to become chunky, plumpy kids or adults. And to me, that's fine. Some are going to like grow out and then up and, you know, but I think that the anxiety of watching bodies change is something to pay attention to also. And with athletes, a lot of them have sort of delayed those body changes, right, because of their sport. And so, you know, it's important to make space for that. So that kid might be kind of essentially, quote, going through puberty changes at 21, you know, and we need to make sure that we're validating, one, that that's normal, and two, that it's hard. It's hard to let your body change. It's hard to not be athletic anymore in the way that you used to be. It doesn't mean you still can't be, but we got to let your body do its thing. So that's its own dimension. There's like so many conversations
here. It's so,
So we
tried our best to cover at least parts of this, but it's complex. Yeah. It's truly complex.
It is.
So people are, you know, hearing this and they want to reach out to you for more support around this, or, you know, they want to follow your work. How can people connect with you?
Right now, the best way is to follow me on Instagram at My Body Positive Home, just because that's really where the most like active conversation is happening and where, you know, my content creation is. Certainly my website, which is bodypositivehome.com. And, you know, maybe to get on my mailing list to make sure that you're up to date on like when workshops are happening. I do offer a support group every other week that has been really nice. It's a Our Bodies, Their Bodies community chat. So far the moms that are coming have kids at all different ages, but we're really exploring this intersection of our stuff and their stuff and our anxiety of feeding them, their appetites, watching their bodies change. And it's like a really lovely, I really enjoy that. But I do offer lots of different workshops, and I have lots of interesting things coming down the pipeline. So follow me on Instagram and join my mailing list through my website.
We'll put links to all that in the show notes too, so people can find you easily. And, I'm going to be paying attention to what's coming down the pike. You got me excited.
Yes. It's just a long haul, like three kids and work and all these things that are supposed to have happened last year, but you know, they're coming.
Well, they'll come when they come, and they'll be there when they're there. It'll be great.
Yes.
But thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It was great talking.
Thanks so much for listening. If you are interested in learning more about attachment science, check out my free guide, The 4 Pillars of Fostering Secure Attachment. In this guide, I teach you how to use the principles of attachment science to help you parent with attunement and trust. By focusing on 4 simple things, you can work towards helping your child form a secure attachment bond, which is a predictor of so many positive aspects of mental health, including self-esteem, independence, healthier relationships with others throughout their lifespan, better academic and workplace achievement, and lower reported instances of anxiety and depression. Not a small list. So to download this free guide and learn the 4 pillars of fostering secure attachment, go to drsarahbren.com/secure. That's drsarahbren.com/secure. And until next time, don't be a stranger.